On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. "We're there," said the president yesterday. With the naming of a new full-term cabinet in Iraq, said President Bush, "we have reached a turning point in the struggle between freedom and terror." Well, maybe. But after many such proclamations over the last 3 years, Americans might be forgiven for not dancing in the streets just yet. Iraqis certainly are not. Their streets are too dangerous. And the new government President Bush hailed is missing ministers in all its key security posts, all of them. This hour on Point, we go to Baghdad's Green Zone, to Iraq's streets, and to Washington to ask what the new Iraqi government, celebrated by President Bush, means for Iraq and for the USA. Joining me right now from Baghdad is Megan Stack, a Los Angeles Times correspondent there. Megan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Megan, give us the basics first, if you would. We've seen cabinet ministers meeting in the Green Zone for years now. What's new about this government created over the weekend?
Well, the government is new because it is a full-term government. It's going to serve, theoretically, for the next 4 years, and that's the first time that's happened. So far, since the invasion, all the Iraqis have been these caretaker governments, which have had temporary custody of the country and responsibility to sort of run the place while they put the mechanisms into place to have a full-term government, which we now have.
Let's look first at the prime minister. He's been there for a while, for months, struggling to create this government, Maliki. The U.S. ambassador, Khalilzad, called him on Saturday a very effective, hands-on, no-nonsense leader. Is that being demonstrated by his last months in power and the creation of this government?
Yes, I mean, I think he's won a lot of sort of begrudging respect from people. I think he's managed to really drive through the negotiations, which, as you know, went on for 5 months, and in the end did manage to come up with some kind of a compromise that satisfied most of the people, at least for the moment. He got a government together with Shiites, Kurds, and Sunnis, which is no small accomplishment in Iraq these days.
It's being called a national unity government, but these three big posts not yet filled: interior, defense, and national security. Why have those been so difficult to fill?
Well, those are really seen as the two linchpin ministries, both for the people of Iraq and for the American government, because those are the two ministries that are in charge of overseeing security. And as you know, security in Iraq right now is pretty disastrous, and the people are really looking for somebody who can be neutral to take the security services in hand, and that won't turn the security services into an arm or a tool of one sect or the other sect, that will actually try to create some kind of unified national security mechanism, which Iraq does not have right now.
So these are pretty important. Together, between these ministries, they control the army, the police, and the prisons. With all the violence going on, those would seem to be core functions. Why did Maliki go ahead and announce this new government with that gaping hole still there, Megan Stack?
Because they were not able to find anybody so far that is satisfying all of the people that he needs to satisfy. I mean, the worst thing would be to appoint somebody who would be seen as biased. They're talking a lot about having an unbiased minister, somebody who won't be serving the interests of his religious sect or political party, but will be actually trying to put together security services for the entire country. And so far, they really haven't come up with names or agreed on names that everybody's comfortable with. So rather than provoke more violence by appearing to hand the security services over to a biased minister, he just chose to defer the question, and they're still trying to figure out what to do with those ministries.
Is it clear when those might be named? Of course, the militia violence there has been severe for months now. Lots of American concern and complaint about it. The idea that uniformed people in Iraq, Shiites very often, but not only, have been kidnapping and killing. These ministries would be key to cleaning that up, but is there any timetable for when these key positions might be filled?
You know, not that I know of. I know that they're trying to deal with it right now, and I've even heard some people say maybe for the time being this isn't so bad. Maybe it's not so bad for the moment to leave these ministries in the hands of Maliki himself and his two deputies, rather than hand them over to the wrong person. So I think that they really are focusing on, rather than rushing to just name somebody, on finding somebody who's actually going to be able to do the job well.
Megan, you and your colleagues have been in the streets of Baghdad talking with Iraqis about the new government. What's the feedback you're hearing? How do Iraqis see this?
Well, we have done a lot of interviews on that question, and I think the thing that came back was that they're desperate for security in the first place, and they're also desperate for services. They're going into another summer. It's getting hot here, and many people still don't have regular electricity, so they're really looking for a government that's going to be able to deliver for them. But, you know, they've also seen these people arguing for the past 5 months. Iraqis went to the polls in December to elect a government. They've been waiting a long time for some kind of payoff, and I think at this point, so many people here are so distracted by daily worries and just the problems of figuring out how to feed their families, how to get to work safely, whether they can afford to buy a generator to run their households, that I think people are not as engaged now in the government process as perhaps they were before, but that's not to say that they're not paying any attention, and certainly they are still trying to find some hope and some reason to have hope.
You quote one 65-year-old Sunni Muslim Arab in Baghdad saying, "We must have hope, but until now we have no sign of hope, not even a glimpse." You quote a young Shiite college student, Shiite, calling Americans the occupiers, though, of course, American force liberated their majority in Iraq to have the power that it now has. And you write that there's a harsh divide between the high-flown rhetoric out of Iraq's ruling elite and the depression, anger, and vengeance on the streets. Describe that gap for us. Are these things connected? Do the formal namings inside the Green Zone really reach out to change life for most Iraqis?
Well, you know, so far they haven't really been able to do that because of the violence. I mean, people who are in the Green Zone and part of the government are really not able to get out of the Green Zone very often, if at all. So they're really locked away from their own country. And meanwhile, the rest of the country is sort of outside the Green Zone, dealing with just often very ghastly situations and just waiting for something to come somehow from the government that they feel is making things better for them. But of course, with so much violence on the streets, it's just very hard to get things accomplished. It's hard to get, you know, the electrical grid repaired. It's hard to get the oil moving when you've got so much violence and so much fighting. And so, you know, it's sort of they're sort of locked in a way at the moment.
You quote a 45-year-old Sunni saying it's security, security, security that's needed. And, of course, that is more complicated than naming a government, as big as that may be. Megan Stack in Baghdad, please stand by if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation, joining us today from Skytop, Pennsylvania, Wayne White. He's a scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department Middle East Intelligence Department. He studied Iraq since 1979 for the State Department. That's a long time. Wayne White, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It has been a long time.
The president says this is a turning point away from terror and toward freedom. I mean, that's rhetoric, and we understand it. But is there a kernel of truth there? Is this a turning point or not, in your view?
Well, actually, I was just on the State Department website to look at that issue, and we've had milestone after milestone after milestone after which a number of related promises have been made. And no, I do not think this has been a turning point. And just two reasons right off the bat. The failure to name a government that can that is finished with this, actually three ministries unnamed, national
right.
security, interior, and defense. That tells us right there that even after 5 months, there was no agreement, and the reason why actually that government was shoved forward was because of a deadline of yesterday, which would have expired, and Maliki would not have had any further writ to put a government together. But I don't think the situation looks promising.
And what about the issue of these three ministries? Of course, they're all about security. Americans making lots of anguished noises about official participation, support, people in uniform acting as militia death squads. Is that the problem here? Is this the sort of civil war, the sectarian strife can't be reined in? They don't know who to name it to pull Shiites and Sunnis and everybody else out of that?
In a recent article, someone, a correspondent, called the situation involving the police, which are deeply troubled and compromised with militia and insurgents, depending on where they are. And the issue of militias is sort of Gangs of New York on steroids. And that is really what's going on. But the reason it's on steroids is because of the very, very serious ethno-sectarian tensions, which some people call civil war. I have sort of a high bar on that. I think as long as we're there, sort of keeping the lid on the kettle, there won't be a civil war. But if we were to leave today, there probably would be.
And somebody needed in those agencies to at least get the government out of the militia death squad business. Megan Stack, what about the American view from Baghdad? U.S. Ambassador Khalilzad has said, told the Associated Press, the next 6 months will be truly critical. Do you feel optimism, guarded optimism? What from the American community there? Megan?
From the Americans, yes, I'm here. Well, I think the Americans are trying very hard to be optimistic, or at least to sound optimistic, because I think that it's very obvious to them that unless they can calm things down in the streets, it's going to be very hard to draw down troops, and it's going to be very hard to get out of here, basically. So I think that they're doing everything they can to feed any hope that they can find among the Iraqis and getting involved in trying to smooth over negotiations between the Iraqis, and I think they're trying very hard to broker some kind of a deal whereby the security services can be brought up to speed.
Yesterday in Chicago, President Bush said the unity government opens a new chapter in the relationship between Iraq and the United States.
The new Iraqi government does not change America's objectives or our commitment, but it will change how we achieve those objectives and how we honor our commitment. And as the new Iraqi government grows in confidence and capability, America will play an increasingly supporting role.
America going to the supporting role increasingly, says the president. Of course, that depends on success from this new government. We've been joined from Baghdad by Megan Stack of the Los Angeles Times. Wayne White is with us from the Middle East Institute. And right now, joining us from Washington is Laith Kuba, director of the Middle East Program at the National Endowment for Democracy. He was a founding member of the Iraqi National Council, an Iraqi opposition group founded after the Gulf War to overthrow Saddam Hussein. He served as spokesman for former Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri from April of 2005 until January this year. Laith Kuba, thanks very much for joining us. Mr. Kuba, are you there?
Yes, I can hear you.
How would you describe the significance of the naming of this new government? Is this a breakthrough, a turning point, a new chapter, or something else?
I think it's a success, a small success, a step in the right direction. It's important. The political process has been put to the test. Can it deliver? It was a bit slow, but I think it did deliver. We have a government simply not made of the winners, but it's inclusive of those also who did not win or did not leverage influence in parliament. It has four blocks instead of simply two blocks that we had before. So I think it is a small success that is worth cheering or celebrating, but I don't think we should fool ourselves that this is going to be the turning point that everybody was waiting for. I think we have some challenges ahead, most importantly, whether or not Iraqis will agree amendments to the Constitution 6 months from now. That is the most important landmark ahead. But short of that, I think this government is going to help improve security, clear off some of the corruption in the country, and consolidate the political process.
What amendments are you looking forward to so critically there in the next 6 months to the Constitution?
Well, the reality is, up until now, Iraqis have not worked out a vision on how they want to rebuild this nation and rebuild the state and government institutions. The Sunnis, who more or less voted no to the Constitution last time, have not yet come up with the amendments or a compromise on the amendments that will make the breakthrough. I see the real challenge is not simply in political alliances that are forming and reforming again and again, but in really having the foundation for that country agreed upon genuinely by the Kurds, Shias, and Sunnis. And I think we have not crossed that point yet.
Laith Kuba, this government has been described as a national unity government, and we see it's got a lot of Shiite, but also 8 Sunni, 8 Kurd, even a Christian. Do you see this as, in fact, a national unity government? Is there evidence that by bringing these sect members into this government, the world outside the green zone is going to move toward greater harmony. Is it connected to that, or is it, you know, living in a bubble?
Well, I think the connection is a little bit distanced, but it is certainly connected. The country is not in a good shape, and yes, there is a lot of violence in the street, and a lot of it is linked to political groups, not only sectarian violence, but there is a political dimension to it. But to arrest that violence and put that fire down, the key to it is to the political process to deliver an agreed vision in a constitution and a strong government. I think we now have a government, but up until now, I don't think we have a genuine agreement on the vision. So the answer is yes, they are able to arrest that violence, but it's a long way from now. I don't think it will happen instantly or in the next, say, few weeks. It will take a while. There will be a decline in violence.
Megan Stack, they're in Baghdad. Do you see evidence that the National Unity Government will actually bring some greater unity to the Iraqi population?
Well, I think it. I do think it hinges basically at this point on security. I don't see how much progress can be made at all unless they can get the streets under control, unless people are actually able to go out from their houses and go to work and come home without being afraid of being killed. I mean, and with, you know, the sectarian killings that have been going on in the past few months, especially since February, I think it's too early even to talk about national unity on the streets, even if you have a government, unless you can deliver some kind of security improvement.
Wayne White, what about from your perspective? Do you see a connection between that nice sort of scoreboard of different ethnic and religious groups represented in the government and the reality on the streets, in particular when it comes to the militias? I mean, the reporting we read makes it almost sound as though elements of the government have been, you know, engaged in the kidnapping and assassination business, this, Shiite wings and others. So, are we starting to cure that with this? Will this ripple out from the green zone to have an impact beyond the green zone?
I hope so, but I doubt it, and I don't think we're talking about weeks if things are going to improve. I think we're talking about many months or even years. The problem with the situation is that the tools that the government has at its disposal are either very badly damaged or infiltrated or slanted in their political allegiance. This means I'm talking about the police. But recall the debate about how many Iraqi battalions are ready, you know, for deployment in order to replace us, which for Americans is a huge issue. The vast majority of those battalions are overwhelmingly Kurdish and Shia. And so there are a lot of us who wonder whether we aren't training one side, or should I say two sides, of a three-side civil war. Because if they are turned loose against a largely Sunni insurgency, we may not see a diminution in violence. We actually might see it increase.
We're talking about the new government in Baghdad. You can join us at 800-423-TALK. Charlie's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if any of your guests could comment on something I heard in the news a month or so ago. I don't remember who was quoted. I believe it was a former administrator of Iraq. Perhaps it was the Secretary of State. But what the comment was is that whenever things got difficult, the U.S. Authority turned to the Shiite militias for help. And so you get the impression that, that the real power in the country is the Mahdi Army, and that this army, that the National Army, is kind of a paper tiger.
We'll look at those militias. Charlie, thanks for your call. Laith Kuba, what about it? Here we have the security ministries, not named, pretty big gaping hole there. The hope is that they would rein in the militia. But how deeply is the government in league with the sectarian militias? How much is it kind of the sectarian militias just under a different badge?
Well, I think we do have a problem because we have armed men whose allegiances, religious or ethnic, are put first before their allegiance to the state. That is just the reality. It's going to be quite a struggle to rebuild national unity where allegiance is really to the state. At the local level, I think you have police force and army force more or less signing up with local authorities. So at the local level, we do not see much of a problem. We do see the local councils controlling their provinces. But I think I agree there is a concern at the national level that we have many armed men inside the armed forces and outside in the street whose allegiances are to leaders, ethnic or religious, not to the state. And that is a problem. And as I said, it was not born overnight. I think that problem is the outcome of, is the accumulation of 3 years of errors, I would say.
Does the failure to name ministers of defense and interior and national security mean that that problem is unaddressed? Or can Maliki finesse this? I mean, your prime minister you worked for, Al-Jafri, clearly was not able to finesse this. Is Maliki in a better position to deal with it? Do you think he'll be successful in naming these ministers, naming ministers who can actually go in and clean up the Iraqi government so it's an honest broker in this arena?
Well, let me tell you the progress they've made. In the last cabinet, ministries were given more or less to political parties on a complex quota system. So the prime minister had little leverage trying to sack a minister or really hold him accountable if they are off target. This is what happened with the Ministry of Interior and other ministries. I think with this cabinet, at least they kept those two ministries, Defense and Interior, outside the hands of political parties. That is the reason it's taking much longer to try to find a candidate who is independent of parties but yet is not objected to by parties. But the reality, as I said, the problem has been acknowledged in the past, and a small step has been made to amend it, and that's the reason for the delay.
But it's a big one. Megan Stack, we appreciate you joining us today from Baghdad. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Megan Stack with the Los Angeles Times. I want to turn now in Baghdad to New York Times correspondent, chief Baghdad correspondent for the Times, John Burns. He's been there covering Iraq since before the American invasion 3 years ago. John Burns, thanks very much for joining us. How do you see the significance of the partial naming of this new government?
Well, I think it's a last chance, really, and I think it's understood to be so, both by the new government itself, by the American military commanders and diplomats who are trying to steer this ship into some kind of safe harbor. And I think they've got, at most, a matter of months, possibly only a matter of weeks, to prove that they can effectively govern, which the outgoing government didn't.
Do you see ministers in the wings coming into these as yet unfilled key positions on the security front, interior, defense, national security? Is that going to happen?
Well, it's certainly a major focus for the Americans here. They think that they have a solid partner in Nouri al-Maliki, the new prime minister. There is certainly an awareness that they can't go down the road that they went last time. If you talk to senior American military commanders in particular right now, what they talk about more than anything else is governmental competence. The notion is this, that a lot of mistakes were made, they're admitted, in the building or rebuilding of the Iraqi armed forces. They think they've more or less got that on the right track now, although they've got a long way to go. But In all the attention that was given to that, very little attention was given by the United States government to building what they call governmental capacity, the competence to govern. That's something that has become very clear during the Jafri years, the year that Jafri was in power, and indeed in the year prior to that when Alawi was in power. Now they've got to get it right. The expectations of the Iraqi people are high. Their patience is pretty well exhausted. The insurgency is undiminished. Political support for the war is diminishing at home. All of this is recognized, and there's a feeling that this has got to be got right, and it's got to be right quick, and that getting it right with the Ministry of the Interior, Ministry of Defense, is where this thing has to start.
So if this is a last chance, and those ministries are as yet unfilled, how does that look? You're there in Baghdad. The promise is that we'll have names there very soon. Is there evident progress toward nailing these down? Or could the whole new thing unravel over these unfilled seats?
Look, the Americans have had to punt on every critical moment of this process since they established it in December of 2003, the progress to full sovereignty and full political independence for the new Iraqi government. At every stage, there have been unresolved issues that have had to be punted. This is another punt. It's distressing. It marred the significance of what happened on Saturday when the new government took office. But as Ambassador Khalilzad said, if it takes a few more days to get this right, then they'll be satisfied. Now, there's an enormous job. If they get the right people, can they do it? Just sorting out the Ministry of the Interior with something like 230,000 armed men under its umbrella, it's going to be a really daunting task. The outgoing minister, Bayan Jaba, whatever we make of his performance, told me and my colleagues in an interview only about 10 days ago that he didn't have any idea what many of those armed men were doing. Well, we know that at least some of them have been involved in forming death squads. Some of them are Sunni death squads operating against Shiites. Some of them are Shiite death squads operating against Sunni. It's going to be a Herculean task to get control of that. And if they don't do that, then whatever chance there is that Iraqi public opinion will begin to swing behind this government will disappear.
Laith Kuba, you were spokesman for Prime Minister Jafri. His leadership has been described as vacillating, lots of corruption, lots of sectarian violence during his time in office. Do you think that Maliki is in a better position to rein this in, this Herculean task of reining in the sectarian militias? Can he do it?
Well, let me tell you what people do not see. The fault is actually in the design of the government and of the Prime Minister's office rather than in the person. Here we have a government that is designed not to have a strong executive, not to have really a chief executive officer. You have a government that has a prime minister, but by default, power, the real power, is so much spread in the hands of ministers, deputies, a couple of councils on top of the prime minister, that ultimately you do not have one chief ordering everybody and moving the country in the right way. This is what Iraq needs today. To compensate for that deficit, short of changing the design of the government from a parliamentary into a presidential system, what one can do is look at strengthening the prime minister's office. I think the real challenge facing Maliki, can he really build a prime minister office that is so strong that can compensate for that deficit in design? Other than that, I just do not feel that he's going to capture and arrest all these strong currents, not only outside the green zone, but even within his government.
John Burns, what about it? There's a call for a strong man, a stronger position, a stronger formal position at the top of the hierarchy there. Do you think Maliki can do it in this parliamentary system that Iraq has?
You know, I think we have to pay close attention to what Laith Kuba just said. He worked right at the heart of this government. And it struck me as he was talking that we have two countervailing trends here. On the one hand, the United States has wanted to see a national unity government here, which includes everybody in the tent. On the other hand, they want governmental competence, which implies, as Laith Kuba says, much greater centralization of authority in the office of the prime minister. Those two trends are working against each other.
Let's listen to the sound of Baghdad for a moment here. Here's Uday Sabr Jamil in the streets of Baghdad saying it's going to take more than the formation of a partial government to stop the violence he sees every day.
Basically, there is no government. From the fall of Baghdad till now, those who came from outside care only about money and power. They don't give a damn about the people. Every day, 50 or 60 more people are killed.
Andre is calling from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Andre. You're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Well, what do you think, Andre?
Right now, one of the things I was just wanted to touch on as far as the U.S. looking for a nonpartisan official to run. There's no such thing in Iraq. It's just like the Democrats and Republicans. You need a party to back you in order to be a candidate. So no matter what, someone's always going to have underlying ties to whatever sect they belong to.
Well, partisan might be okay, but if it's all sectarian, that gets rough to handle. Let us pick that up. John Burns, how about it? Can anyone in Baghdad escape the sectarian gravity there? There was a time when Iraqis were proud of not being trapped in sectarian roles. What about now?
One view of this is that, as somebody we spoke to in Sada City the other day, one of our reporters found, somebody said, we're going to have to burn for a while. That there are pent up resentments and the anger and the dysfunctionality that's got to be worked out of the system. At some point or other, I think there will be a new strong man emerge. We don't see him yet, but we probably wouldn't see him in the early stages. Is Maliki that man? If he's going to be, he's got to have a government that works. It's got to be an Iraqi state to which people begin to attach their hopes and their loyalties. At the moment, there is no such Iraqi state. Saddam Hussein achieved it by brutality. You either gave your loyalty to Saddam Hussein or you likely died. The effort here is to achieve something else altogether. Who the strong man might be, who knows? But in time, he'll emerge. In the meantime, I think there's going to be a transit through considerable chaos and bloodshed.
Wayne White, help us understand how the Bush administration may be really looking at this. The president talking grandly in Chicago yesterday, of course, he has to. At the same time, they'd like to get U.S. troops out of there. He's been very frank, so has Karl Rove, in saying this war is killing his popularity at home. Surely they're not under illusions inside the Oval Office about how tough it's going to be. We've heard the word strongman now from late Cuba and John Burns. How do you think that the Bush administration is actually figuring the forward calculus here? Are they really betting on the success of this government? Are they looking for some further transition to help get U.S. troops out of there to stay in long term? What?
I think there is that hope, and the administration, I think, has walked forward with a misimpression, which was as this process continued all the way from 2004 up, that it would gain momentum. And Ives was arguing inside government when I headed the Iraq intelligence team in state as early as 2004 that they had it backwards, that as things became more permanent, equities would become more bitterly fought out, and we would run into the problems we're having now, like having 5 months to form a government. One of the things that your caller from Arlington said was very, very interesting is that you can't find anyone in Baghdad who's nonpartisan, and there's a lot of truth in that, because to the extent that Zal has to get involved, our ambassador, Zal Mekelilzhan,
yes,
has to get involved in trying to be sort of the honest broker at the table, just demonstrates that in some ways the only neutral party out there is Zal.
But Iraqis have been frightened to death by these death squads. We read about the middle class fleeing the country. I mean, it's not easy to be nonpartisan, non-sectarian anymore.
It's a very serious problem, and that is an exceptionally strong point to be made here, that the people who have the most broad-based view of Iraq, you know, as an entity, a more secular intelligentsia, are the very people who are fleeing the city in huge numbers, Baghdad, and a few other parts of the country, other urban centers. These people were the ones who should be manning the government. These are the people who should be voting for it and standing behind it. And they're not only leaving because of militias and ethno-sectarian violence. They're leaving because the crime rate is out of control. Their daughters are being kidnapped for ransom. Things like that are going on. But, you know, going back to the Bush administration, what is dismaying, I would assume, to them is that even though they're not talking about it, their time is very limited, not just by their term in office, but by the polls here in the United States. How much longer is the American domestic population going to support a large U.S. troop presence in Iraq, either under this administration or another? I don't think that much longer. Maybe a year or two you have. So it's got to work now. This is perhaps our last chance.
Last chance, Ambassador Khalilzad saying something like that, John Burns saying that. Laith Kuba, let me ask you, with this described as a national unity government, might there be a way to reach out to the insurgency and its wings at this point, if we can even look at it that way, and negotiate a peace to say, look, everybody's in this government now. We're sharing power. We're sharing, you know, what we've got here. Let's stop this fighting. Is that just a dream, or is there any chance of that actually happening, Mr. Kuba?
No, I think this started to emerge in the last 6 months. There is one small elected political group that is known to be close to the insurgency. They have currently 11 seats. They are not part of the government, but they are part of parliament, and they're talking to everybody. And they're facilitating more or less those side talks. But when we talk about the insurgency, let us not forget, it is not one thing called the insurgency. This is a blanket term that is covering foreigners, religious extremists, criminal networks. And one element of it is a political one that is was fighting the foreign occupation, that is protesting the political process and can be engaged because their needs are political. For the rest, you cannot deal with them. You just need a state that will enforce the law and clear the atmosphere. But for the political element, I think, yes, there is progress made. It's not full, but I think there is progress. I said it, and I'll repeat it earlier. The make or break for Iraq is going to come in 6 months on whether the major block of Sunnis who are currently in government and in parliament agree amendments to the constitution. If they don't, then this the level of violence can escalate by many folds.
John, in Baghdad, how are the Americans and the American troops seen in the midst of all this? Iraqis looking on, they don't have security. They do have a new government. We're surprised to read news accounts of Shiites who have been generally floated upward by the American presence there, now calling the Americans occupiers. Explain that to us.
The American troops are in an extremely difficult position. I think the main trend here that is observable in recent times is that all the main political components in the new government, the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Kurds, are all saying they want American troops to stay, and not only that, that they do not favor any early withdrawals. Now, it's true also that you find here and there, and obviously amongst the insurgent groups, people who want to get the American troops out. You hear the word occupiers, yes, amongst Shiite groups who are frustrated, many of the Shiite political groups, that the transit to Shiite majority power here has been, if you will, reined in by the appointment of a national unity government. They've waited an awful long time, by some estimates, 350 years, to wrest power from the Sunni minority. They've done it on the backs of American military power. Now they find that the American military power here is constraining them. They don't like it. But when you get to the bottom line, do they want American troops out? No, they don't, because all those engaged in the political process here recognize that a withdrawal, a significant weakening of American military power here might doom this entire enterprise.
But fascinating resentment there, even from the Shiites, who would like to sort of put the pedal to the metal and really exert the newfound power. Mike is calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, America.
Hello.
Hey there. Hey, what I'm thinking about with this between the Sunnis, the Shiite, and the Kurdish, I don't think they'll ever get along. I don't think we're going to ever get this completed. What I'm thinking is if we separate three different states, form a committee for the oil, 2-3 members of each state, and let them divide that money and wealth. We will never, ever get them to stop fighting.
So partition the country. What's your perspective here, Mike? What do you know about it?
Well, I'm a Gulf War vet, and I just got back last August from Iraq. The people, our occupancy is really more of a problem than it is a cure in that country at this time. I'm not saying pull out immediately. What I'm saying is we need a separation of the three states. And what we need to do is have them form a little committee to divide that oil wealth.
Right, so that everybody's got a stake, but partition it, you say. And you were there in the U.S. military, Leith Cuba. How about it? Is there still an active conversation around partition, or is that just another path to civil war?
Well, I think on the northern part, one can think of some sort of self-contained state. But the real problem of Iraq is not in the north currently. It's in the rest of the country. And in the rest of the country, you simply cannot think of dividing areas geographically. It's because the communities are so intermixed, not only in neighborhoods, but even in marriages. You have about 40% of the Arabs are intermarried, especially in Baghdad and in other big cities, Basra or Mosul. So really it's a big problem, and I think once you unfold that idea, then there will be cleansing and forced immigration, but you will not solve it. You're going to open a wound that will continue to bleed for the next 40, 50 years.
But John Burns, isn't that kind of ethnic separation already happening? We're reading stories of people changing their names so they can't be identified, people leaving one neighborhood, moving to another where they're not a minority. Is that already underway?
Yeah, it is underway, and it involves probably the families every day. Where there's mixed populations, but Faith is absolutely right. It's very hard to see how you can actually unscramble, if you will, this omelet, especially in the city of Baghdad, in Mosul too. If you look at the ethnic map of Baghdad, it's taken only one city, but it's a city of 6.5 million people. You can see how thoroughly intermingled people are. And the progress towards a separated, partitioned state would involve a civil war, the heartland of Iraq, of such ferocity that it would make everything that has happened to date seem like just a warm-up.
Wow. Steve is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
How are you?
We're well. What do you think?
Any of your commentators to give thought to the fact that every time we seem to have these conversations, it's a big if. If this happens, if this happens, if this happens, we'll get to some point down the road. George Will the other day on the Stephanopoulos This Week program said what goes on in the green zone is totally disconnected from what goes on 5 miles away in Sadr City. I don't understand why we don't cut to the chase and acknowledge how this isn't going to work and then start talking about what we're going to do with the fact that it's not working.
Let's do that. Wayne White, how about it? If one accepts that view, of course, the president doesn't want to. Lots of people don't want to. But we're hearing last chance here. It means you've got to consider the alternative. If let's say, it doesn't work, what then?
Well, that's the problem, that nobody really wants to go there, whether they should or they shouldn't. I agree terribly with your other experts that breaking up the country is just not really workable, or should I say would be very bloody and could be prolonged, with Baghdad being the poster child, as was Beirut, you know, for a civil war-like scenario. I think, unfortunately, however, that if this doesn't work now, if a vision of a working central government that can deliver not only security but electricity, it always reminds me of that great quote from Lenin, what is needed is Bolshevism plus electricity. Mm-hmm. And in Iraq, what you need is security and electricity. If a central government can't do that, we are going to see this country break apart. And it's going to be very ugly. That's the fallback plan. And I think that's why a lot of people don't want to go there.
John Burns, what's plan B here if this does not work? After all, they got three big posts still unfilled even now.
I think you could invert this, and you could say, it reminds me, there are many differences, but it reminds me a little bit of being in South Africa during the worst years of apartheid, when they used to talk about the alternative being too ghastly to contemplate. That is to say, collapse into civil war and bloodshed there was too ghastly to contemplate, and therefore they worked it out. There is no plan B here. And the United States was in Vietnam, unpalatable as it was at the time, there was an alternative. The Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese were standing in the wings and did, in fact, as you know, take over very quickly. There is no such alternative here. It's hard to imagine the United States pulling out with the ready knowledge that it was going to descend quickly into a civil war, which would destabilize the whole Middle East. Iraqis, however much they complain about the present situation, all know that civil war lies just beyond the horizon, that this isn't made to work. So although almost all the indicators continue to look downwards, there is still the feeling that somehow they're going to have to work this out because there is no acceptable alternative.
John Burns, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent, Bureau Chief for the New York Times in Baghdad. John, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Laith Kuba, last word goes to you. What's your level of despair or optimism as we talk today? John Byrne says it has to work. Can it?
Well, theoretically, there are ways. There are designs even that will please the Shias and the Sunnis and the Kurds, even with the current constitution. The real test is, do we have politicians with sufficient maturity to work it out? My guess is that from what I see, they need help. It was the right thing to do to pass authority to people to vote, like morally the right thing to do. But whether what it was the best thing to do, I'm not very sure. Being there, I think we just have to work with those politicians and try to do our best.
One great big cloud ahead, and on we plunge into it. Laith Kuba at the National Endowment for Democracy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Wayne White at the Middle East Institute. Wayne, thanks for your conversation today. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.